Let's start by discussing your education and training. Can we start by describing your educational background?
Sure. I was born in New York City, and I went to public schools, graduated from high school in Bayonne, New Jersey, Bayonne High School. I then went to Fairleigh Dickinson University in New Jersey. Got a bachelor's degree in chemistry. I graduated almost a year early, and so I worked as a coffee chemist at Maxwell House. Good memories of that. In Hoboken. And I used to eat lunch in a little park called Elysian Field, where On the Waterfront was filmed.
Oh, wonderful.
Then I went to medical school at McGill University. Graduated from McGill in 1966. During my summers, I did research in cardiology in Costa Rica. And then I did my internship in medicine at the University of California in San Francisco, 1966 to 1967. During the Vietnam era, in the Berry Plan, assigned to the Navy, and there were experiences I made in Vietnam when I got an offer of a job from the National Institutes of Health in the Division of Regional Medical Programs, headed by Robert Q. Marston, later went on to become the director of NIH. So I came to NIH. I did 1 year with the Division of Regional Medical Programs. Then I began at the NIH a residency in clinical pathology. And I completed 2 years, which was the full residency period. Then I returned to the University of California in San Francisco as a resident of medicine. Fellow in oncology. The hematology training was largely at NIH. I spent the 2 years in clinical pathology. I spent about a year and a half in hematologically related work. Then I joined the faculty as an instructor in medicine. That ended my formal education. Not my education.
Of course. What factors influenced your choice to go to medical school? How did you become interested in medicine?
Well, I had some good motives, and perhaps some motives that weren't as high-minded. The good motives were an interest in biology that was engendered by a biology teacher in high school. And the memories I have of that was looking through a microscope at a drop of water from the aquarium and seeing all those life forms. I liked science and I liked biologic science, and I wanted to combine biologic science with some service to mankind. I didn't want to just do science in isolation, but I want to do it in a way that I can apply it directly one way or another to patient care. Suppose I had another motivation too. I recall him from a poor family, and there was a certain desire to, for lack of a better word, make it. What exactly constituted making it, but I think in my mind at that time, becoming a doctor was equivalent to whatever making it was supposed to mean. And in retrospect, particularly in that era, in the 60s, a physician was held in respect, and that once you became a physician, you had a title of respect. That was different than, for example, simply becoming a lawyer. If you became a lawyer, you then had to become a successful lawyer. So I think there was some attraction to a very clear level of accomplishment. And maybe that wasn't the timeline to go, but it was there. It influenced me. But primarily I was influenced by the good things, by an interest in biology and the desire to be a surgeon.
You mentioned the cultural movements of the 60s. Did any of that then change how you felt about medicine? Since this is the time that you're completing your education. And
no, it was particularly at McGill, a very classical school. I consider that I was privileged to have an unusual quality of medical education. Frankly, a quality that I'm not sure is easily available today. Not only the depth of the medical and biomedical scientific learning, but a deep sense of heritage, respect for patients, the privileged position of the physician with respect to the responsibilities that the physician takes on by accepting that role. And I can recall that I was shocked when I made rounds at other hospitals when I was looking for an internship, particularly in New York, at the extreme informality of the house officers. We pretty much stood at attention by the bedside, 1 foot away. It was something that's stuck with me. One professor, general, Professor McNaughton, who's a famous neurologist, used to show us various signs and symptoms of neurologic disease of students. This was before the CAT scan era, and the neurologic skills in localizing lesions were so highly prized. He would point these out in patients who had deficits, but would do so in such a way that the patient was never embarrassed, nor ever made to feel that they weren't being treated with the greatest of respect. And that's something that stands out in my mind. The exquisite attention he paid to the patient and to the patient's feelings regarding their participation in the teaching exercise. So it was a great school, not only for content, but also for philosophy and tradition.
Okay. So then what drew you to hematology and oncology within medicine?
That's interesting. When an individual from a poor background goes to medical school, I think they have a different image than perhaps someone from a privileged origin. Medicine, I considered medicine to be surgery. This was before I got to medical school. And because that basically was how you fix people. And so I thought I was a surgeon without giving much thought to it. I simply didn't question it. I was very focused on the day-to-day efforts of medical school. this time in McGill, the examinations were given at the end of the year, and if you failed two examinations, one or two, I think you were allowed to make it up in the summer. And if you failed again, you would be asked to leave the school, and a large number of students were, so there was an element of survival. So we wanted to make it, and that's where all my attention was. But I just assumed I'd be a surgeon. And then when I got to do the surgical rotations, I did notice that I was a little bored just holding the retractors. I was so confused that I actually applied for surgical internships as well as medical. And the head of medicine then at the Royal Victoria Hospital in Montreal, Dr. John Beck, who subsequently went to UCLA, and I got to be reacquainted with him. Rather accomplished endocrinologist and certainly the senior physician at the Royal Victoria Hospital, called me into his office and said, Goldie, what is this I hear about you going into surgery? So I remained fairly mute, or stammered probably. And he then said, do you like to sew? And I said, no, not particularly. He said, then why go into surgery? He said, I didn't reply coherently, I'm sure. And then he said, well, you know, where you should go is UC San Francisco, and you should go to Dr. Holly Smith's brother. And I went to Dr. Holly Smith's brother. There was a matching program, but I'm actually not really in the matching program. But that was the era, and that's how decisions were made. When I got to internship was pretty much like leaving your life. Not that medical school wasn't intense, but internship was a total immersion. And that year, it's hard to remember any details, but at the end of the year, one had a somewhat Superman-like feeling. I doubt it was justified, but like the most extended boot camp you can imagine. This was at a time when lifestyle, that phrase didn't exist.
Right. Okay, let's move on to your early career after your formal education was completed. How did you end up at UCLA?
Well, first, I joined the faculty at UC San Francisco, and I got into hematology because when I was at the NIH, I was in the clinical pathology program, and one had to choose among hematology, chemistry, or microbiology, and I chose hematology. And even though in medical school I thought I was a surgeon, it turned out I was quite capable, in fact, fascinated to sit for hours on end and look through the microscope. So I repeat this to my junior colleagues, that sometimes we think we know what our nature is, and it turns out that that perception is a prejudice. It's a view that one gets of themselves that's not a studied view. So I saw myself as very active, physical, hence surgery, or at least cardiology. Certainly not a passive kind of specialty, which involves morphology and looking through microscopes. But you find out a lot about yourself, and find out something that great patience for. love. And so I always tell youngsters, don't say you're no good at this or you can't that, because I'm trying these things to find out, you know, where your inclinations are. So I joined the faculty and began my own laboratory. I've worked in the laboratory of Martin J. Klein, later to become famous for the first attempts at gene therapy, somewhat well starred. I was a junior faculty member. I was, I would say, only partially independent. I still depended heavily on Dr. Klein for support in my research. But I got a great start in immunologic research because while I was at the NIH, I had extensive experience in reading bone marrows and dealing with the enormous pathologic material that was available. And we also had a ritual in which I would sit at the microscope and the clinicians would bring the bone marrows of their patients, and I would, like the Oracle at Delphi, declare remission or relapse, and really became involved in the whole process. And I got to be a fairly accomplished morphologist when it came to bone marrow. So when I began to do my studies in the laboratory, I directed my work at where blood cells were formed, which was the bone marrow, and what I wanted to do was to understand what regulated the production of blood cells, because I had the then somewhat naive dream that once we knew what regulated the production of blood cells, that we could actually control the production of blood cells, which was really a novel thought for that era. Even many of the leaders in hematopoiesis never believed that so quickly we would find information about the humoral factors regulating blood cell production and how we could actually use these. That's been the greatest scientific joy of my career. Going from a period where it was almost unthinkable to actually seeing it and participating in the development of some of the first hormones that would regulate blood cell production. While at the University of California in San Francisco, I got to know Gordon Tompkins, a leading biochemist whose life was cut short, an acoustic in the room, and C.H. Lee, who was the first man to purify growth hormone. These were two senior scientists at UC San Francisco. And Gordon Tompkins was famous for dissecting the early part of corticosteroid hormone action, and CH Lee, of course, for polypeptide hormones, particularly growth hormone. That's the wonder of our academic communities. I met Dr. Tompkins on the bus, the UC bus that used to go back to Marin County, and on Fridays we would stop and buy beer and have pretzels. We had a nice bus ride, and I was worried about the people who got off at Santa Rosa, which was the end of this long bus ride, because the longer the bus ride, the more beer you drank. So Gordon Tompkins told me, when I explained what I was working on, he said, well, you don't have purified cells, and you don't have a purified hormone, so it's hopeless. you either start with purified cells and go to purified hormone, or you start with a purified hormone and figure out the cells. So he advised me to begin working with corticosteroids, dexamethasone. And C.H. Lee told me the same thing, only he advised me to work on growth hormone. And it was through my connection with these endocrinologists that I got the vision of hormone action and hormones working through receptors, and could actually picture hormones in the body interacting with blood cell precursors, regulating their production. And that set the stage for searching for human colonies, human breeding factors, which had been identified about 1966, or at least the supposition that they existed, based on in vitro culture techniques that were developed in Israel and Australia. I have many contacts at UC San Francisco that also stimulated my interest. There was a pulmonary physician who developed pulmonary lavage, and it was through him that I began working on pulmonary macrophages and came to understand the macrophage system as an extension of cell production in the bone marrow. So I left UC San Francisco on the first day of January 1974 to go to UCLA because Dr. Klein had been recruited to UCLA the previous year, and I was still a very junior in my development and underfunded, and felt that that I still needed additional support before I could build up the kind of laboratory effort that I wanted to. So I went to UCLA, and that was the hardest move I ever made, because the difference between San Francisco and Los Angeles is a lot greater than many people might imagine. But I survived it, and I stayed in UCLA for 18 years.
So while you were building up a laboratory there, did you think of yourself primarily as a clinician or as a researcher, and how did you envision this balance between doing laboratory work and doing working with patients?
Well, in those days, there were very good role models for physician scientists. There was a clear path for the physician scientist. I don't think they would call that in those days. I think we just used the term academic medicine to cover this. Certainly at UC San Francisco, there were an enormous number of role models, including the chairman of medicine, Dr. Holly Smith, who we could emulate. And they used the phrase the triple threat man. Was man because at least prior to that time, this position was man. The triple threat referred to research, teaching, and clinical care. And so you should be a clinician like Sir William Osler, a teacher of Greek mythologic proportions. A fabulous investigator. There's a lot of talk now about whether such a person could exist or did exist, but I believe a person like that did exist. It was a simpler time. The amount of biomedical information was much more limited, and that there were very clear role models for this, and the goal of the academic pathway, of course, was to become an associate professor with tenure. And that usually happened at the time you gained acceptance to the American Society for Clinical Investigation, otherwise known as the Young Turks. So the pathway for the physician investigator in those days was rather clearly delineated.
You feel such role models are now lacking for them?
It's a lot harder now. The truth is, to be a superb clinician, it would be hard to have time to do other things and achieve at that level. What I find myself doing over the years to try and maintain my clinical prowess, such as it is I constrain my clinical activities to a narrower and narrower range. So when I finished my fellowship, I took the boys in oncology the first year they were given. I'm not sure I know what that year was, but it was the early 70s. I thought it was a fairly easy examination. Now it's a comprehensive one. But my clinic contained patients with brain tumors, breast cancer, hematologic cancers, gynecologic cancers, cancers of all kinds, because the surgical specialist, didn't want to deal with advanced cancer with metastatic disease. That was a medical oncologic problem. Also, I have to say that oncology was not held in high esteem in that era. It was not one of the classical medical specialties, such as metabolism or endocrinology, cardiology. And I would see a clinic sometimes 15 or more patients with a folk degree of tumors, which today would be unimaginable, particularly at the institution I'm at now, where the whole basis of our care is super subspecialized. We also used to mix up our own chemotherapy.
Mm-hmm. If you can put yourself back in the 70s, where did you see your research going at the time? And where did you see your career going at the time?
Well, in the early 70s, I was pretty well set on the quest to understand what regulates the production of blood cells. And I was in a very good environment to pursue that, because there's a very ample scientific collaboration and collegiality, an informal environment, which some ways is lacking today, a culture of scientific collegiality, a very strong culture. The bus to Marin. I'm sure there are many stories very much like mine of the direction of people's research being governed by interactions on the bus. Also, there was a culture of studying human disease, studying it in humans, and taking blood and studying that blood, and of course the hematologist was particularly focused on that. I set up the first bone marrow donor, normal bone marrow donor program, and bone marrows were considered very painful in those days. I think they were painful because they weren't done very well. Treating as they were done in the sternum. And when I put up the signs that we would pay $50 for a bone marrow donation, my colleagues, my junior colleagues, laughed at me and said, no way. And so I became the first volunteer, and Dr. Klein did a bone marrow on me. Unfortunately, he did a sternal bone marrow. And they are painful. And subsequently, I've had many bone marrows done, but they're done in the posterior ilium. A bone marrow aspirate can be done without much pain, and without much discomfort at all. And ultimately, $50 was a lot of money in the early 70s. Ultimately, I had a lot of donors. Remember, my secretary was a conscientious donor. And so we obtained human material to work on, human bone marrow, and I was working on these bone marrow cultures where I could use my morphologic skills as well as some of the biologic studies. And as I mentioned, we also looked at macrophages. I got an understanding of how macrophages evolved from bone marrow progenitors as well. And in addition, we subsequently found out that macrophages can proliferate in situ. So one of the exciting works of that early time was a Nature publication I had showing that the human alveolar macrophage was capable of replication. And that was done in collaboration with a pulmonary colleague. Unbelievably, he used a Foley catheter. Foley catheters are normally used to drain the bladder, but they're made of soft rubber, and he found it ideal for doing alveolar lavages. And I even did an alveolar lavage on him. His name was Theodore Finley, originally from University of Washington in Seattle. And a lot of the early work was what we might call descriptive now, but I was searching for the cells that produced colonies in the factors. And one of the early works showed that the monocyte in the peripheral blood produced it, and subsequently we showed that the activated lymphocyte, which we later came to understand as the T lymphocyte, produced the colonies in the factor. So the early work was ascertaining the cellular origin of these colony stimulating factors, and determining some of the modulators of them. For example, endotoxin was known to stimulate colony stimulating activity production in mice, and I ultimately went on to do this in humans. And there's a well-known story of auto-experimentation where animals died at the UC San Francisco. What I was doing, it's shown that if you inject endotoxin in humans, you could increase the serum concentration of colony-stimulating factor. I had the notion that one could produce colony-stimulating factor by injecting endotoxin, take off the plasma, and then use that plasma therapeutically. And here again, the advantage I had was that due to my background and contact with endocrinologists, I had a vision of how these colony-stimulating factors worked as hormones. And And when I say vision, I mean it quite literally. I had an actual picture, just another hormone that interacted with a receptor on the cell. Now, others in hematology, even though they themselves discovered many important components of the hematopoietic system, somehow never believed, very skeptical, that these factors were actual physiologic factors that we could use to actually control blood cell production. So these early experiments with endotoxin ended up where I injected myself with perhaps too much endotoxin and went on a cell separator so that we could obtain an adequate amount of plasma. And I guess the combination of the endotoxin and the fact that I was having a reasonable amount of my plasma volume removed caused me to lose consciousness. But I had an agreement with the woman who was running the machinery that should I pass out, just give me back some of that plasma. And she did that, but in the interim she also called a code blue. Called the cardiac team. So luckily, my consciousness returned before this team dispatched me to my eternal rest. And there's a famous story, and that many people talk about it. Anyway, ultimately, we showed that this plasma, when given to a single patient, a child with neutropenia, actually stimulated the production of neutrophils in that child. And of course, that experience left me absolutely and totally convinced that that we could isolate these colony stimulating factors and that they would prove therapeutically useful.
So, can you just
enumerate
what colony-stimulating factors are useful for them?
Yeah. Well, now, of course, there are actual drugs, mm-hmm. and they're not called colony-stimulating factors. But the hormones that regulate hematopoiesis are now a broad family. Erythropoietin is the best known, and erythropoietin stimulates red cell production. It's used widely in renal dialysis and kidney disease. It's used very widely in cancer therapy. Now it seems commonplace to think of stimulating red cell production, but it was hard to conceive of it at one time. The white cell colony stimulating factors, there are known as GM, CSF, granulocyte, macrophage, colony stimulating. GCSF, these have been developed as drugs used to stimulate white cell production, mainly in cancer-related conditions, but also in others.
Okay. If you can return to this question of materials for a bit, you talked about self-experimentation and also obtaining materials from other lab workers and from donors. Do any of these come from patients, and how are materials obtained for research purposes from patients?
It was very commonplace in the 70s, even the late 60s, to study patient material. And before the biotechnology revolution, I would say that it was only medical scientists who pretty much did that. That's what defined the medical academician, was someone who studied human disease in humans. And it was uncommon for a PhD scientist, I think, to actually directly study human material. Cell lines were derived much earlier than the 60s, but and these cell lines became important. Agents for biologic study, but directly studying human material was in the province pretty much of academic positions. By the time I began my career, we had IRPs, we had human subject protection committees, and review committees, and one got informed consent. I think the hematologists probably were most used to this because drawing blood was so common and so we were used to doing that. Bone marrow was a little bit of a step, and I'm sort of amused now that it's commonplace. And as you know, people donate large volumes of bone marrow for actual transplantation.
Who would have access to these kinds of materials, and would researchers share those, or would they remain within?
The primary tissue was generally shared within laboratories, but no one had much notion of sending them anywhere. They were perishable anyway. Mm-hmm. Cell lines were more available, but many of them weren't useful, particularly some of the hematopoietic cell lines, a large number of them were leaky virus transplant B cells. Didn't always represent the underlying disease process.
Did you have much interaction with the ATCC at that point? Did people who work on cell cultures do much with?
Well, I don't remember when I learned of them. I didn't have a lot of contact with them early, but they've been in existence quite a while. I dealt almost exclusively with primary tissue, and frankly didn't have a good notion regarding the utility of cell lines and what I was doing initially. Mm-hmm. That's one way of addressing it.
As cell lines started to become more useful to you, what kinds of things would you look for to determine whether it would be worth the effort to do a cell line? I know in the 70s it took a lot more, it was more complicated to establish a cell line than it might be now.
I frankly didn't know much about, I knew about their existence, I didn't use them, because there weren't great hematopoietic cell lines. I was working with myeloid tissue. There wasn't a myeloid cell line that we could use. The lymphoid cell lines were frequently EBV transformed B cells, which were things I was interested in. And I would have to say that I was sort of determined that primary normal tissue was the important thing for me to work on. I would say my early work was entirely focused on that. I think I ignored the established cell line until later. Later, getting back to my conversation with Gordon Tompkins, who said you either have purified cells or purified hormones, if you have neither. Forget it. I came to understand that I did need pure cell populations to work with, and particularly when we were looking for a source of colony stimulating factor to purify. And we looked at a number of established cell lines. Didn't have a sense that non-hematopoietic cells would make the colony stimulating factors. Now others found cell lines that non-hematopoietic cell lines that did as bladder cell line from which GCSF was purified here at Monash Monterey. My initial work showed that macrophages, monocytes, made the colony-stimulating factor that I was studying, as well as activated T lymphocytes. So that's where I focused my efforts. There weren't good macrophage cell lines, and most of the T cell lines that were available weren't mature T cells, and so tended not to make it. Now, our techniques were crude too, so I think with finer techniques, we would have found, as we know now, there are many cell lines and many tissues that make these colony stimulating factors, but we didn't know it then.
You mentioned at one point that the hospital there did have IRPs and human subjects committee. What impact would you say that the bioethics movement has had on biomedical research?
Things have turned many times, because from the guinea pig notion, the abuse notion, it's turned around to certain types of medical research representing access, and therefore if you were not eligible for these types of investigations, you were, quote, denied access. I think that came to the fore at about the beginning of the AIDS epidemic. And so it's gone through a lot of transformations, and in fact I can remember when there was a movement whereby it was said that prisoners shouldn't be denied access to clinical trials in the context of the AIDS epidemic, whereby it was felt that access represented the ability to be treated by newer and perhaps better drugs. So it's been somewhat of a moving sociologic phenomenon. I think our current techniques for regulating human experimentation are pretty thorough. And there's always the risk-reward balance in the changing sociologic notions of what a clinical trial or clinical research represents, all the way from perhaps unnecessary intervention to access to important new techniques.
To ask a related but more specific question, in 1978 the California legislature passed a Protection of Human Subjects in Medical Experimentation Act, and it basically stated that explicit informed consent had to be given to use materials for research. Is there any discussion of that among people, the human?
Yeah, well, it still requires interpretation, because even if informed consent is obtained for tissue, let's say surgery, pathologic tissue, the question is what can be done with that tissue. If the informed consent is general, and says, for example, it's scientific research, then some might argue that that it's not sufficiently informed consent on the basis of lack of specificity. If it is specific, then is research delineated or delimited to that specificity. And well, there are many arguments surrounding this. And there are competing rights. I think privacy issues are important. But also there's a imperative to advance medical science.
Well, on the topic of advancing medical science, can you say a bit about the discovery of HTLV-2 and how you saw that fitting into your work and what that meant for your future?
Well, that was an accident. At UCLA, there were two important cell lines that were developed in my laboratory. One of them was the KG1 cell line, which was a myeloid leukemia cell line that proved to be important because the cells responded to colony-stimulating factor. So here was a cell line that was a pure cell population that could respond to colony-stimulating factor. The cell line turned out to be important for other reasons. It was a cell line from which alpha interferon, at least one of the alpha interferons, was cloned from. And it was developed by a fellow working in my lab, Phil Kepler, hence the name KG1, Kepler Building 1. And that cell line has been very useful in biomedical research. It was the second myeloid leukemia cell line. The one previous to that was known as HL60, and that also became an extremely useful cell line. The other thing that came from the KG1 cell line that turned out to be very important in hematology was CD34, which defined CD33 and CD34, which defined a stem cell and a progenitor population, and CD34 cell selection is a common means of enriching those stem cells. And there were many other myeloid cell lines that were developed subsequently, and they've all proved to be, or many of them have proved to be exceedingly useful, and all for different reasons. Some have had the chromosomal abnormalities that have been useful in cloning breakpoints. Their reagents have been very useful for the development of, for example, differentiation reagents, first through the mouse cell line, but subsequently with the human myeloid cell lines. So the other cell line that we developed that became well known, we developed a number of cell lines. It's pretty much like cooking, at least in those days, very much like cooking. The development of the cell line was not a rigorous scientific feat. We thought we were pretty experienced cell culturists, and we thought some of our techniques were particularly useful, but these are not the kind of things that are studied formally. I was studying hairy cell leukemia, which the disease I became interested in, because as soon as I got to UCLA, I was formally presented at a conference with a patient with hairy cell leukemia. And I had gotten to know that condition well from my time at the NIH. It was not a well-known entity. I told them that I thought the patient had hairy cell leukemia, that some of the senior hematologists were sort of taken aback. This particular patient was not treated optimally in retrospect. became very sick, and I got to know him, and I suggested that he have a screen taken out. Once the screen was taken out, he had a very long remission. Disease, but it was very counterintuitive, because why take the spleen out if the disease is in the blood and the bone marrow? And still, and yet, we don't understand completely the role of splenectomy in various cell leukemia, but it was an effective therapy, and some of the other more traditional treatments at the time should have been avoided. Because of that, my familiarity with the disease, other patients were referred to me, and I was going to become an expert in the disease. And I just, the first is you get thought of as an expert, and then it becomes a reality because you see so many patients with it. This first patient, wasn't the first patient based on the thing that I'd seen, but one that I'd become involved with. Everyone was concerned with what the cell origin of various cell leukemia, what kind of cell was it? And there were great debates in the literature at the time, and so with some colleagues I undertook to study this. And we came to the conclusion that there were B cells based on the fact that they could synthesize immunoglobulin. And we were trying to develop cell lines so we could study it in more detail. And then a very famous patient, subsequently to become famous, was referred to me again because I was known as an expert in that area. He was a younger patient than I normally see. And he had absolutely massive splenomegaly, perhaps the biggest splenomegaly I've encountered. And he had otherwise typical hairy cell leukemia. And so we recommended the splenectomy, which was performed. And the usual European nephrologist had a piece of tissue and trying to make a cell line. And what was unique about this cell line was that it was composed of T cells. Mature T cell lines were not common. They were very rare at the time. And this would, sort of contradicted what we thought we had determined with some precision, and that is that the cell of origin of the hairy cell was a B cell. There's a hard to interpret literature of variants of hairy cell leukemia composed of T cells. And we subsequently concluded that he had a T cell variant of hairy cell leukemia, which I now doubt. In any case, knowing that activated T cells made colony-stimulating factor, we tested this cell line for the production of colony-stimulating factor, and we found in fact that it was a producer of good colony stimulating activity. And so ultimately I decided that we were trying to purify this hormone, that I had a notion of hormones from the cell line, and that turned out to be very difficult fact. We worked on it many years. We didn't purify, even then we purified very tiny amount, about 1994. So I've been working on the colony stimulating factor since about 1972. That was a long trip. We found other things in there that we could have found elsewhere, but we were sort of fixated on these T cell factors. We found a activity we called erythroid potentiating activity, EPA stimulated erythropoiesis, and we purified that, and ultimately working with the genetics of Boston found it. And that turned out to be TIMP2, what is now known as TIMP2, tissue, liver, and metabolic proteinosis 2. And so it was a very exciting time because with the impact of molecular biology on more classic biomedical research, there was the ability to clone genes, to express proteins, to do that which previous things aren't doing. And also a lot of surprises. Many people who were purifying proteins thought they were all working with different proteins, found out they were all working with the same one. And people who thought they were working with the same one, when ultimately they were cloned, found out that they were different. And so erythroid potentiating activity in attempt to interesting somewhat of a diversion. But the techniques we used for purifying called EPA were then used, turned out to be GM-CSF. We were busy purifying GM-CSF, and I'll finish that story. We finally purified it. Judy Gasson, who was in my laboratory at the time, was the first author, the other science article. She is now the director of the Johnson Company Cancer Center at UCLA. So it was rewarding when your young colleagues and students turn out so successful. Phil Kepler is a full professor at UCLA. He's a very successful investigator as well. So, in the midst of all this exciting activity, human leukemia virus, retrovirus, was isolated in Bob Galler's laboratory from a T cell line that came from the patient with a believed to have a type of T-cell leukemia that affects the skin, and this was called HTLV-1. And I was presenting some material, I believe, at a meeting in Europe, and describing the MO cells and what they were producing. And Dr. Gallo felt that this was very reminiscent of the cells that were found in HTLV-1, and ultimately we sent in material to look for a virus, and he found a retrovirus that had properties that were somewhat different from HTLV-1 and justified it being given a different designation, a different strain, so we found HTLV-2. And then at that time, I had a young postdoc, I guess that's redundant, well, most postdocs are redundant, a very skillful man, Irvin Chen, who just finished his PhD with Howard Tubman at McArdle in Wisconsin. And he came to the lab because he wanted to work on the GM-CSF. His background was in retrovirology, given who his mentor was at Wisconsin. But he felt that retrovirology wasn't going places because there's no human retrovirus at the time. He was extremely bright and hardworking. And here, HTLV-2 pops out of one of our cartridges. So he turned to me one time and he said, what do you think if we try and clone HTLV-2? And I said, well, at cloning a virus in those days wasn't a trivial matter at all. You know, there were no kits, there were no way to get reagents, and it was an undertaking. And particularly since my laboratory was certainly not a virology laboratory. So we frankly discussed what that would entail and the competitive nature of it, given Dr. Gallo had a very huge effort in human retrovirology at the National Cancer Institute. The brashness of youth has its advantage. And he said, well, if you're committed to it, then he would be my idea. And of course, I said, well, if you're committed to it. And so we made a mutual commitment, and a very small band of people and reagents that he got from his mentors at Carl, which proved to be key here. And also some molecular insight that Irvin had. We successfully did this now. what Irvin did was to do a SAW-3A partial digest. So the issue here was in cloning the virus, you have to pick restriction enzyme to put it in the lambda phage, and since you don't know exactly which restriction enzyme to use, and as I recall, HTLV-1 had an echo on one site somewhere in the middle of the genome, I believe that's the case. We came up with the whole marrow genome. And I don't remember the year, but it was a meeting in Keystone where I used to put on about a thesis meeting at the ski resorts. UCLA had an enterprise wing. And we were sitting in the audience. Irvin was going to present the cloning of HTLV-2, and Bob Gallo was there. And I think Bob had it first and showed a half of the genome of HTLV-2. And apparently he had to use the EchoR1. Now I recall, HTLV-1 had no EchoR1 site. And HTLV-2 had one in the middle of the genome, I think the second one, and so he cut it now.
Right.
And I was sitting there with Judy. Judy Gasson was sitting next to me. And, I don't know, there's a competitive nature to this because she let out a gasp of delight at what we have to do now. And, of course, we published that as a full article in the front of Nature. And Irvin went on to great success. He's the head of the AIDS Center at UCLA.
So was this the first cloned human retrovirus?
No, HTLV-1 had been cloned. But the cloning of HTLV-2 turned out to be important because it's somewhat of a complex genome, not as complex as HIV, but an appreciation for what was then known as the X region, the TATS region, started to become clear by looking at the homologies between HTLV-1 and 2. And then a group at UCLA went on to actually study these, what were then called the X proteins, including Dennis Lehman, who's now the head of hematology and oncology at UCLA. And so an appreciation for those regions of without reaching the HTLV genome and some of the there was some other phenomena. I remember we had a paper in Science that dealt with a transcriptional detail that it had never been seen before. It was an unusual skip in transcription of the viral genome. But it was so exciting in those days that even a detail became... So that raised all sorts of problems because this virus pops out of a culture, and the question is, does the patient have the virus, or is this just something that, that appeared in the culture? And ultimately, the NCI group came to UCLA to meet the patient and the family, and we did some studies of our own too, and it turned out that in fact was infected with HTLV too. But no one else in his family was. And well, the story of HTLV too is it's a very common virus. And blood banks screen for it, and it's widespread across the world. We don't know what, if any, disease it's associated with. We subsequently found another patient with clear cell leukemia who was infected with HTLV-2. And that patient ultimately died. We were able to do a pretty definitive study that showed that his hairy cell leukemia was a B-cell clone, and that he had a clone of T-cells infected with HTLV-2. So, in retrospect, I now believe that the original patient, Mr. Moore, may have had a B-cell hairy cell leukemia and a T-cell clone infected with HTLV-2, and that the cell line we obtained was this HTLV-2 infected T-cell that may have or maybe there's a relationship, but the relationship is not directly causative.
Okay. Right. Related to this in a different way, some historians of science have talked about the 1970s and the early 1980s at the time when the oncology researchers were jumping on a molecular biology bandwagon, a term that they use. Do you see this as an appropriate term, or what do you... How do you think oncology has reacted to molecular? I think it was one of the
seminal turning points in medical research, and certainly in oncology. Molecular biology involved an understanding that individual genes could be isolated and studied, and that proteins could be made, usually from what we call seeding RNA, but proteins could be made from this genetic material, and the leverage of this technology was enormous. In fact, so enormous that to this day I don't believe we fully appreciate what a huge step that was. And you know, rightfully, the double helix, the early discoveries are seen as seminal events in science. You know, it's equivalent to nuclear fission. Use of an understanding of radioactivity. Huge, because you know, things happen in science at certain intervals that are unpredictable that simply change the whole paradigm of what's possible. You know, there are one or two billion patriot or something like that. 200,000 genes. Soon, we won't know every gene in the human body. We'll know every gene in every microorganism. And that kind of knowledge has just changed oncology and medicine in general. I should mention that I did a sabbatical, I think in the end of the 70s, with Tom Ananias in Caltech, and it sort of changed my life. Tom had constructed the first human genomic library, and the fears at that time, he had to do it for fetal liver, because if he used some adult tissue, he could be cloning some Andromeda strain. There was great trepidation in the field regarding molecular biology and the dangers of cloning. In my time with Tom, his name, it's been a hard few years now, it was seminal in thinking about what could be done medically. And Tom went on to found Genetics Institute, because that was the connection to the biotechnology company. And the other founder was Mark Potashnik, who happens to be here in the Wild Line Kettering. But I think by actually working in Tom's lab, he's trained an enormous number of people in science to visualize genes and to see the leverage of molecular technology. I think it's underestimated to this thing.
And I think it's switched gears a little bit to biotechnology and business and medicine. How did you begin consulting with pharmaceutical companies? And how do you think consulting has changed, and how do you think perceptions of consulting has changed in the past 20 years?
Well, that's an interesting question. I have to say, I mean, very little about pharmaceutical companies, except they used to give us pens and little lights and things like that before it was considered immoral to accept such gifts. I'd say I had almost no contact with the pharmaceutical industry until the advent of biotechnology. And then through my friendship and contact with Tom Ananias. I knew that many of the things that we needed to do, particularly in cancer, but in biomedical research in general, required industry. And the biotechnology industry I found very appealing, because these were composed mainly of young people, wildly enthusiastic. Genentech with the clone of dye t-shirts. It was an era, and it was something to appreciate. So that was my first contact. And the reality is that people like myself don't make drugs, nor is that our role. We're not capable of doing it. It's something that requires industry. And it's hard to make heroes out of pharmaceutical companies, but the truth be told, they are the ones that make a lot of the things that are useful to man. Medically. Now, it's done on a substrate of basic academic science, without question. And I think we've now come to appreciate that interplay, an appropriate interplay between academic enterprise and for-profit medical industry, is in the interest of society. us to let them know properly is a challenge at times. Subsequently, I was a consultant for the Genetics Institute for 7 years, and it was our collaboration with them that we cloned the MCSF, and this erythroid potentiating activity. Well, we did a number of other things, and one of the great advantages we had is we produced GM-CSF in the lab, Judy Gaffin, a very tedious process, extremely tedious. And, you know, we got to do some of the early studies, but then Genetics Institute, of course, was able to construct mammalian cell lines that produced huge quantities of it. And then many scientists had this available for their studies, and we benefited equally well. But there's always room for abuse in relationships, but I see a lot of the advances in medicine coming from this interaction with the private and public sector in biomedical research.
How did the changes in federal technology transfer that were associated with the biotechnology industry change your work? Or did they have any effect? Are you aware of them?
Well, everyone, I think, came across the problems of universities protecting intellectual property, things like inappropriate transfers, and with molecular biology, it's information. It's not information the gene is enough. You can transfer a gene without transferring any physical substance, simply a sequence. And so there are a lot of things that had to be worked through. And we had one of the early agreements with biotechnology, but there were many at UCLA, and subsequently, it's like many other areas where the pendulum has swung to both sides, and now it seems to have gotten somewhere near the middle, where the rights of all parties have to be recognized and accounted for. And universities now are aggressive in protecting their intellectual property, and the pharmaceutical industry has always been aggressive in that area. And I think even with all the contentiousness regarding patents in the biomedical area, the alternative to patents are trade secrets. And that's anathema to academic science, and certainly not generally in public interest.
How did your experience with the Moore case change your attitudes towards medical research or towards these kinds of technology transfer issues?
Well, the lawsuit, even one that you win, was unpleasant. And that was unpleasant. And it highlighted the fact that there are unexpected non-fields out there. That one has to be aware of, and it's made biomedical research more complex. And I said that the pendulum has swung to different extremes. And that may have been one of the extremes. I was gun shy for a while thereafter. It's not easy for an academic physician to extensive in-depth dealings with lawyers and where the publicity associated with it. And I was a little gun shy, and who knows, maybe to this day I still am. I don't think that's a good thing. I was hesitant to continue to use patient material. Why? But, for example, the use of the virus to establish cell lines has proved very productive because in looking at genetic disorders, the T cells are usually more reactive cells and sometimes better to work with. And so with the virus, we could construct cell lines that permanent cell line that recapitulate the genetic nature of the individual community of pain. And one of our projects involved pygmies in Central Africa, where we set up pygmy cell lines. One of the anthropologists at UCLA was capable of going to this remote area, and we got informed consent, but sure, one can always make some arguments regarding how informed this particular group of people could believe that those cell lines are at the ATCC, and they've been useful in examining why, in fact, the pigments are in short expansion.
Is that part of the Human Genome Diversity project at all?
Yeah. Okay. I always maintain an interest in growth hormone. Work with endocrinologists.
Okay, well, if we could just turn to the big picture. We haven't spoken much about your more recent work, but looking back over everything that you've done, what would you consider to be your most important contribution to medicine?
Well, it's hard to know because it's hard to know what in retrospect will be many years from now. The use of colony stimulating factors in human therapy is so commonplace now that it's hardly considered unusual. And I have the feeling that if it weren't for our work, there were other, certainly other people very skilled in the field. I'm not sure in any way change the course of some important rhythm in life. Maybe, in the end, the most important discovery was a more recent one involving vitamin C. What we discovered there was a fundamental mechanism, probably a universal mechanism, by which vitamin C is taken up in cells. It had been known for many years that there was a relationship between vitamin C uptake in cells and glucose. But the nature of that relationship was unknown. And when I came here to Memorial Sloan Kettering, I met Juan Carlos, Vera, who began working in my laboratory on the oncologic and immunologic issues that I was interested in. But he started talking to me about his interest in transport. And much like my conversation with Irving Chin years previously, I guess I'm easily sold. He started to explain to me some theory he was talking about. He told me about the glucose transporters. And I mentioned that this relationship of vitamin C and sugar. And it caught my interest, and we worked on this together, and we ended up proving that, in fact, vitamin C enters cells in the form of dehydroascorbic acid through the glucose transporters. Now, there is another family of transporters that requires energy and is less widely expressed, but every cell has glucose transporters. And I got very excited about it. We published that in Nature and basically showed that dehydroascorbic acid goes right through the glucose transporter, whereas ascorbic acid does not. And this has all sorts of implications. It says many things, among them that extracellular oxidative events lead to the generation of the transportable form of vitamin C. So that the body has some setup whereby oxidation itself facilitates the attention by cells of vitamin C. So I was very attracted to that. We've done many detailed studies for those not interested in transport, I'm sure it'll seem boring, but we did an exciting study in vivo where we ascertained the form of vitamin C that crossed the blood-brain barrier in rodents. And we injected ascorbic acid that was labeled, and we injected dehydroascorbic acid, and the dehydroascorbic acid crossed right into the brain, and ascorbic acid didn't. So that led us to the notion that dehydroascorbic acid might be used as a therapeutic. Since it involved, we thought that with regard to the brain, its utility might lie in degenerative central nervous system disease. We ultimately licensed to a biotechnology company this technology. We're not neurologists, if in fact oxidation is a fundamental mechanism of mutation and indeed aging and maybe other diseases, degenerative diseases, then vitamin C, being such a potent antioxidant, might have a real role in reversing some of the diseases. And we ourselves would be most interested in, obviously, the prevention of cancer. So I'm enthusiastic about the development of dehydroascorbic acid as a very potent pharmaceutical to regulate the cellular content of vitamin C and thereby regulate the cellular content of antioxidant. Now, of course, everything has to be connected to hematopoiesis. So the reason I became enthused with the glucose transporters is because GM-CSF signals for increased glucose transport. So it wasn't just that my younger colleague was